You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So we've been working through the book of Exodus in general and the Ten Commandments in particular. Now we get to what is referred to as the second tablet. In this tablet, we move into how to relate to other people, not just to God. Let's look at commandment number 5, honor your parents, honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving to you. In our culture, parents are depicted in the media as inept. The media are really good at making parents look dopey. You know, the sitcom father, dopey, dysfunctional, doesn't know what he's doing, alcoholic. And then the mom, really sharp, really tough, and also really condescending to the dad, disrespectful, and controlling. Hyper-anxious, controlling of the family. I don't know how much this is deserved. Maybe it is deserved. Maybe parents really are checked out, and they don't care about their kids. And yet, at the same time, I will say definitively, show me a sitcom where the father is strong, smart, and respected, and I will kiss you on the shoe, okay? I really will. You don't have it. Phil Dunphy, his last name is Dunphy, first of all. And he doesn't know what he's doing. He wants to be everyone's buddy. You know, man, he's dad. Where is he? You know, he's charming. He's smart. He's never around. He's disengaged. The old guy, I can't remember his name. You know, he's Manny's adopted dad, but he's relationally disengaged. Everything is wrong with the modern family. And so it goes. Children in our culture are viewed to know best. It's always in the movies and in TV shows that the kids are the ones with the insight. They know what they're doing. At best, parents are your peers, your friends, but there's no sense of honoring your parent. Like there's someone that is above you. Nothing like that. All we have is, you're my buddy. Buddy, buddy, buddy. And again, I don't want to overstate this and say that we shouldn't be friends with our kids or our parents. We should. It's good to have a friendship, but it's also good to honor our parents. This isn't in the sense that everything that they do is honorable, as we know so well of our parents. They're sinners, like us. And so that's not the command. The command is to honor them as persons. In extreme cases in our culture, kids deserved, and I don't know what word to use, other than kids deserve to be worshipped. Let's look at that, the Disney Channel, this show here. Girl in the Middle. And look at the way that was all choreographed. Everyone, the dad and the kids, and they're all looking at the cute girl. And she's going, I'm cute. I don't know what to say. This show here, what's that one? Who cares? Anyways, the show, the kids are, yeah, we're in charge. We're in a hotel and we're rich and we run the show. Manna Montana. Every episode. Not that I watched it. Every episode ends with her singing. It's every Disney Channel. Now, I'm not talking about Disney Plus, which is quite good. I'm talking about the Disney Channel. It's like everyone is just worshiping the person with the microphone, and they're talented, and everyone loves them. Gross. This whole picture is just gross. And if you had shown this to anyone from any other century in humanity's history, they would look at this and say something is fundamentally flawed. In reality, when we look at childhood actors and actresses, we see the deleterious, damaging effects that this leads to in one's life. Having an 8-year-old kid who's very verbally fluent and charming become a millionaire to the point where they're actually the one running the household. They're a childhood dream, they're a family name in everyone's home. And look at how they turn out. In jail, hooked on drugs. I mean, Lindsay Lohan, such a sweet girl, and then all of a sudden just crashed and burned. Drew Barrymore, you know, got into pornography, alcoholic at age 9, turned her life around. Praise God, that's great. But my point here is not to laugh at these people or to say, oh, yeah, these people are so sinful. My point is any one of us who is thrown into that kind of a situation where everyone is just saying, you're the best, you're the center of the universe, you're so awesome. Any one of us could not withstand that sort of weight to carry on our shoulders as kids. This is profoundly inhumane to children. And I like to think about the extreme cases where you basically have a kid raising himself and he's a millionaire and he's in charge. And this is the way it turns out. Then you have a family where you have a mom and a dad and they're trying to work with the kid and love and nurture that child. But they're also leading that child. They're in charge. What is it like if you're somewhere in between? How does that work out for a kid when the kid is at the center of the family? Not good. Honor your father and mother. How exactly do we do this? Well, we just taught on this in Ephesians chapter 6. You'll have to go back and look that up. Let's keep moving. Commandment number 6, murder. You shall not murder. This is the term used in Hebrew not for any sort of generic killing, but specifically for manslaughter. The Hebrew Bible, as well as the Bible as a whole, has a very nuanced ethical perspective when it comes to taking human life. It isn't just that it's absolutely wrong. It's not that it's a war hawk killing everyone in sight. It's nuanced. If there's manslaughter, if there's intent in many ways, that's what's wrong. That's what's being called out here. The taking of life to protect life, not wrong. The taking of life for the sake of judgment, justice, not necessarily wrong. And so we have a very nuanced view when we come to the Bible. It's not just murder wrong. It's not pacifism or being a war hawk, is I guess what I'm saying. And yet, in our culture, we can't even agree on this one. We can't even agree. You can't take innocent human life. You can't even agree on that in postmodern culture today. Many people espouse a view referred to as moral relativism, not moral realism. See, I would consider myself a moral realist. I think morality is real. Relativism is that morality is just the flavor of the month. Whatever is good for you. You know, one person's art is another person's pornography. And that's just the way that our culture handles morality by and large. But they stumble when you get to very serious moral, objective moral wrongs like murder. We had a group go down to Cincinnati to interview some students on campus down there. Why don't we check this out?
Well, first question that we have, do you think that there's like a universal moral law or not? What do you think about that?
No, I don't think there really is.
I wouldn't say necessarily a law, but I'm definitely a firm believer in like karma.
I think so. I think as humans just living, I think we have an obligation to just be kind to everyone.
In my elementary school, there was a treat others the way that you would be treated. I feel like that's probably like the most important one.
That's a good question. I think that most human beings, at least in today's world, have the same moral law. I just think some people decide to break that law and just kind of ignore it.
I mean, I have my own moral standards, like be kind, but everyone upholds their own things. So I guess that really depends on person to person.
Do you think if somebody who was a practicing Nazi or a practicing slave owner came up to you and they were like, what I believe is right, do you think you could definitively tell them that they're wrong? Or do you think you'd have that perspective of, you know, it's just their perspective?
Yeah, no, that's a good question as well.
It's definitely like wrong. I don't think that should be really a thing. I feel like everybody pretty should be equal.
I feel like I've definitely been, like, thought about this before, and I'm a big advocate for just people believing in what they think, but I think there's a line that has to be drawn somewhere.
Those are pretty outdated things among society, and it's all looked down upon.
And, you know, I think everyone should kind of have the ability to believe what they want to believe and voice what they want to voice. Granted, I think there's a very large gray area between what's right and what's wrong, and again, I feel like that comes back from my perspective.
I would more than likely try my best to educate them in some sense, and give them facts and reasons behind my stance. I think one of the beautiful things is that we're all allowed to think whatever we want, even if it is wrong sometimes.
And also, it also comes back to, you know, society and kind of the environment they're in. You know, if you go back to the, you know, 1800s and ask about slavery, I'm sure it's a very moral thing to do because it's very normal.
That's back them silly. I'm Jewish.
How do you think you could have the ground to say that they were wrong?
I mean, personally, people that are so strongly driven in those kind of beliefs normally don't have much background to base it off of, and I feel like wouldn't listen to me either, so I would probably just ignore it and let them be haters.
So do you think that your viewpoint is one that just you should subscribe to, or do you think that all people should subscribe to what you think?
I think everyone has the right to their own opinion. I think my viewpoint is a more common viewpoint on that matter. But again, people are allowed to think what they think.
So I think people should believe on some things I say, but like I don't. It's like other people should have other opinions. Like I'm not going to judge anybody for what they say. It's like their opinion. So
I think everybody's entitled to their own beliefs. Like for me personally, I'm not a religious person. And that's, I think, where a lot of my karma comes from, is that for me, karma kind of takes that place of religion and gives me something firm to believe in.
So I think kind of the idea of breaking the moral law is really like opinionated and based on the perspective that you're looking at it from, I think.
Did you see their faces when they're like, what about the Nazis? What about them? That one guy looked like he was going to pass a kidney stone. He's like, my goal is not to do the YouTuber thing where destroyed college students in 5 minutes or something. I hate that stuff. These are people that are very confused. These are people that God loves. But these are people that are also wrong. That view is wrong. That's a wrong view. And you could tell because it's internally inconsistent, going back and forth. Well, we should educate them. So we have a moral obligation to educate them. We ought to do that, morally speaking. Yes, we ought to do that. Well, I don't believe in a moral law, but I think that is wrong. That's contradictory. You can't have it both ways. When we come to the Bible, we see a very firm foundation for morality, which is based on God's own nature. Why is it wrong to round up the Jews like vermin? That's what they were called. Why is it wrong to hold Africans as chattel, literally property, chattel slavery? Why is that wrong? Because these are people that are made in the image of God. That's why. And so Christianity has a rock solid foundation for ethics. Very, very persuasive. Nothing like what we see when it comes to post-modernity. Therefore, what we're seeing here is an objective standard. Yeah, people are entitled to their beliefs. They can hold what they want to hold. True. Therefore, does it follow that they're right? No, it doesn't. I subjectively hold beliefs that are false. So do you. But would we say that because I subjectively hold them that therefore they're right? No. So even murder, no wonder we're having so many problems being able to have discourse, civil discourse in our culture. We can't even agree that there is such a thing as right and wrong. Well, number 7, sex. You shall not commit adultery. Why is the Bible so restrictive on sex? Here's my thoughts. I think you should be able to have sex with whomever you'd like, whenever you want, as many times as you want, wherever you'd like. I mean, I could go on and on. I think that you should have complete and utter freedom to have sex however, whenever, with whomever. If sex is not a moral issue. If sex is not a moral issue, then go to town. Go have fun. I don't care what you do. But if it is a moral issue, if there's a moral component to sex, then all of a sudden we should have certain restrictions as we would in any other area of life. Indeed, every worldview places restrictions on sex precisely for this reason, that we see there is something different about sex. It's not just the giving and exchanging of fluids, all right? There's something profoundly moral about sexuality. Adultery, voyeurism, that's being a peeping Tom. Some people say, well, you know, it's not giving consent. Consent, so consent is the restriction. We need to have consent. Why would we need consent if sex isn't moral? What if you're a peeping Tom, but the person that you're peeping never knows? There's no one getting harmed. In fact, the peeping Tom is enjoying himself. What's the problem? Necrophilia, that's got to be a sexual issue where there's no victim, right? The person, necro meaning dead, philos meaning love, having sex with dead people. The dead person doesn't care. The only person that's having sex, I guess they're enjoying it. But isn't there something just blatantly right in your face just going, that doesn't just make my stomach turn. It's not emotivism. It's not just, ooh, I don't like that. It's that it's, wrong. It's wrong to have sex with a corpse. Pedophilia, sex with kids. Well, you can't have sex with children and stuff. We all know that. Yeah, we do all know that. That's a restriction. Why? Because sex is moral. That's why. I mean, we could go on. I could list restriction after restriction after restriction. The Bible has restrictions. The question is, why does it place certain restrictions around sex the way that it does? You see how we've moved from it shouldn't have any restrictions to which restrictions are the best. Here, the Bible is saying that what we have are restrictions from the creator and designer of sex itself, the one who created this for humans to flourish. He was the one who gave us sex, and he's saying it's between one man and one woman for one lifetime. That is the design in which we operate. Our culture has a very difficult time with this. From our perspective, more freedom means more flourishing always. If one episode on, you know, Netflix is good, then 10 episodes is 10 times as good. More freedom, more flourishing. It ain't necessarily so. You know, the designer of a car would say, keep that car on the road, right? Because they designed it. You technically would have more freedom if you took that car out into the ocean and drove it in the water. That's more freedom, technically speaking. But we're restricting ourselves to the road. Why? Precisely because more freedom doesn't mean that you're flourishing more. Let me hit you with a question. What's your long view on sex? What's your long view? You're like, what do you mean? Presumably everyone in this room wants to have sex and have lots of it and enjoy it, right? There's a lot of people here, I'm assuming, that want to have lots of sex, right? Right? Okay, yeah, I got an amen there for a second. I thought we were in a Baptist church. It's like, wow, okay. Okay, so how are you going to get that goal? How are you going to get that? For some people, they're just going to watch porn indefinitely. Like, okay, I'm not actually going to date or marry or whatever. I'm not going to do that. Sex is just going to be refined to looking at porn indefinitely. Not very many people go this route. I think people who are addicted to pornography, even they would say, that's not what I want. I want something that is more fulfilling than that. So what about number two? Watch porn until you get married. You know, I'm watching porn to deal with my sexual needs, urges. I can't help myself. But then when I get married, that's when I'll stop. Or maybe not. Maybe I'll keep going with both. Let's think about erectile dysfunction and pornography for a second. Did this study recently. What percentage of men aged 16 to 24 experienced erectile dysfunction? This was taken in 2012 and then again in 2016. What did they find? 30 to 45% of young, virile men are having a hard time getting an erection. Now you say, well, maybe there's just something going on. Whoa, hold on. Let's compare with the older men and younger men. Older men in 2001, 2002, I'm speaking of really old men like 40 to 80, not 38. That's young and beautiful. But I'm talking about 40 old. Like you hit 40, your T goes down, your testosterone goes down, and 80, it's completely gone. Okay. 13% of those men have erectile dysfunction. 2011, men aged 18 to 40, they have from 14 to 28%. Wait a minute. They got tons of testosterone. It's coming out of their pores. And they're having twice as much of an issue with erections. What could be the difference there? How could you have an 80-year-old man be doing better than an 18-year-old man? High-speed internet, 2008, where the only barrier to you getting porn was how quickly you could download it on your hard drive. That's the only difference. And we see there is a widespread phenomenon of ED in our culture precisely for this reason. I could labor this point and the effects of porn on your sex life. I'll just leave it at this. You're messing with something very sacred. When you start screwing around with this, saying, yeah, I'm going to mess around with this now and later my sex life is going to flourish. I hope it does. I really do. I don't wish you any harm. I'm just saying the data don't show that. They don't demonstrate that. All right. Porn. No. How about hooking up? I'm not into porn, but I do want to have lots of sex because sex is great. So I'm going to get into hooking up and I'm never going to quit. I'm not going to do the marriage thing. I'm just going to hook up over and over, get on Tinder, swipe left or right. I don't know which one's which, but you swipe one way or the other, and eventually, you know, you find a mate, and then you hook up, and it's just a casual sex, and you never see each other again. See, many people, I think they want to go this route, and yet at the same time, they sense, okay, indefinitely. Have you met men who are 50, 60 years old who are womanizers? Have you met them? I could say many things. I'll say at least one. Profoundly unhappy. Profoundly unhappy. This is not the way to go. And singles, way less sex than married people. Married people in their 20s and 30s have sex once or twice a week, somewhere in there. Singles, not nearly that much. Oh my God, not even close to that much. So if you're looking at actually just pure sex, how much sex you're having, not the way to go. Number four, hooking up until you get married. I'll just do hooking up until eventually I settle down. See, the data don't show this as being healthy. Here's a study that was done that says that hookup culture and hooking up, casual sex, leads to, quote, increased likelihood of suicidal ideation. It has lower levels of self-esteem, life satisfaction, and happiness. See what that's saying? Life satisfaction. It's like, what's my life all about? It's just going from partner to partner to partner. It's existentially meaningless. Just bumping into other people, looking for pleasure. It doesn't lead to happiness. Higher levels, quote unquote, of generalized anxiety, social anxiety, depression, and sexual regret. That what seemed like such a good idea ramping up on the way down, it was like, I shouldn't have done that. Some of the most bitter regrets people hold are in this area. Painful, deeply painful to our soul. How about this? 9 out of 10 people needed to drink alcohol before engaging in casual sex. Now, why is that? Why is that? Isn't it because we know at a fundamental level that we're doing something incredibly meaningful, incredibly sacred with a stranger that we never want to see again. We want to use their body and never know them as a person. Let's look at this. The average married couple has sex once a week or twice a week, somewhere in there. Let me add. 1% of married couples have sex 5 times a week. Some don't at all. 9% don't have any sex. Okay, so but I'm saying on average, there's about once or twice a week. Desirable duration of sex lasts anywhere from 7 to 13 minutes. So if you add that up, let's go with the 13 minutes. And we add that up, you know, once a week for 52 weeks. That would be 11 hours of sex that you're having with your spouse per year. You're like, why are we getting into such gross details about married sex? Here's the point. You're having basically a day of sex a year. What are you going to do with 8,000 hours with that other person? You're going to have to talk to them at some point. How about this study? Durex condoms. This is not from First Fundamentalist Church of Christ, right? Durex condoms did a study. They said 96% of people interviewed said that emotional connection brings the best sex. Oh, it's so revolutionary. Like you'd actually want to know the person and love the person with whom you're having sex. Like that's such a 92% vulnerability was a sexual turn-on for men and for women. 94% said sex is better when your partner wants only you. Can't imagine that, huh? Why? I would really want it if my partner was just hooking up with people left and right, was hopping on the computer to look at sexual images constantly. No. This is the way it is. Durex condoms are supporting what the Bible has taught all along. 5, cohabitation. Why don't you just cohabit? This is another thing. See, with the divorce rate on the rise, people have been raised in homes where their parents were divorced, and so now they have equally high level of desire to get married, but they're scared. And so they don't want to actually get into marriage, but they don't want to be single. So they've come up with a new idea, a mutation of the two called cohabitation. We cohabit. We live together. So we live together. Why? So that we can get to know each other. So I see if this is going to work out, if there's anything weird going on. And then eventually I'll get the ring. We'll be engaged for several years. And then maybe we'll get married, but we're going to ease into it very slowly. Cohabitation. Great idea. Great idea. You know the person before you just leap into marriage. Is it? No. The research on this is univocal. One voice from all different strands, sociology, psychology, the soft sciences, the hard sciences are coming in one after the other with studies. Cohabitation is the kiss of death for marriage. Let's compare. You think about breaking up. What are the chances if you cohabit versus you get married? 5 times higher for cohabiting couples. Why would that be? Because there's no commitment. That's why. There's no promise. Oh, I thought you could leave your toothbrush at my house. That's not commitment enough, baby. Versus standing up in front of your friends and family and saying, I'm going to be with you for life, through thick and thin, rich or poor, sickness and health. Oh, the back door is wide open. You can skirt anytime you want. Infidelity with cohabiting couples, 2 to 8 times higher that they're going to cheat on you. Why? There's no commitment in a cohabiting couple. All you're doing is splitting the rent. And I'm not saying that if you're cohabiting, you don't love each other, that you don't have feelings of love for one another. Of course you do. You wouldn't live together if you didn't. What I'm saying is you don't have commitment for each other. Commitment says, I'm sticking with you whether or not I feel love toward you. What about the divorce rate of those who cohabit and then eventually marry? Twice as high. So this whole idea that we're going to dip our toes into the water and just slowly get into the pool little by little instead of actually just making the choice we're getting into this together, this actually has the reverse effect. That is heart-wrenching. People who are already scared of getting into marriage, and marriage is on the decline in our culture. Divorce is rampant, and people are scared, and yet they're trying a certain way to get into this, and yet the divorce rate is actually twice as bad. It's already bad. This is twice as bad. What about if you have serial cohabitation? I move in with her, and then we break up. I move in with her, and then we break up. I move in with her, and we get married. So you have serial. The divorce rate is 4 times as high. Why? Because you've learned a very important skill. When things get tough, you leave. When things get difficult, you have an exit strategy. So the divorce actually becomes way worse. What about happiness? Cohabitation versus marriage? Marriage is 3 times happier. This is marriage in our culture. It's not even doing well. These people are 3 times happier than cohabiting couples. Do not commit adultery. God's way on this. Very good. Very wholesome. Very awesome. And it isn't like you're just jumping into the pool blindfolded. This isn't arranged marriage. You're dating. You're dating the other person. You're getting to know them. And you're developing a relationship. And then that's building something into more intimacy until you eventually do get married. Number 8, stealing. You should not steal. You shall not steal. This is prohibited, as we've been seeing all along, based on God's own nature. God is not a thief. Jesus said, the thief, he comes to kill and destroy. I came to give life, give it abundantly. John chapter 10, verse 10. Romans 8, 32, it says, if he did not spare his own son, but gave him up over to us all, how will he not together with him freely give us, catch this, freely give us all things? God is just a giver by nature. And yeah, you said, well, I've given things over to God. God will take things out of your life. Nothing that's worth anything. Paul says in Philippians chapter 3, I was a scholar, I was religious, I was wealthy. And he says, I call all that skubalon. That means it's a dirty term. It's a swear word. It's literally a vulgar term. And Paul was using a cuss word there. Anything I had, it wasn't worth anything to begin with. So God is this way. When we steal from others, what are we saying? We're putting a price on that relationship. If I was to steal money out of your wallet, what am I communicating? I'm communicating this, that our friendship is the price of that money. That's what I'm saying. I put a price on it. I steal $20 out of your wallet, our friendship is worth $20. What about when it comes to refusing to work? People that are unable to work, people that are disabled, they need our mercy, our help and our compassion and our giving. That's what they need. People that are able to work but refuse to work, what about them? That's stealing. What is that communicating? Why don't you get up and go to work? I'll just crash on the couch. You get up and go to work. You go to school. You do whatever you got to do. I'm just going to eat your ramen noodles in the kitchen. That's stealing. That's what that is. That's stealing from other people. And Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 3, whoever will not work will not eat. What does he mean by that? Eventually, the person's going to get hungry enough that they realize, yeah, I better get a job. Because that would actually be better rather than being hungry and not being able to feed myself. The goal in this area is not just to avoid stealing, because God wants us to be a giver, not a taker. Ephesians chapter 4, it says, steal no longer. Why? Why wouldn't I want to steal? But work with your hands so that you have something to give to other people. So much more satisfying than taking from others. Yeah. Commandment number 9, lying. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Again, based on God's own nature. He's not a liar. He cannot tell a lie. It's part of his nature. There's different forms of lying, of course. There's the flat-out slander. You said something knowingly that was false to make somebody look bad. There's other forms, though, too. Flattery. Ah, I hate that, man. People come up to you and just tell, oh, you're so such a special little... Flattery. It's like you're trying to get something out of me or get away with that. Not like encouragement where you need some help. Exaggeration. I'm Irish bred and born, so we can really spin a story. And sometimes the story, if somebody else told it, I wouldn't have even been a member of the story. But when I tell it, I'm right at the center of the story. It's an exaggeration. What is that? That's lying. That's lying. Selective telling. This is where you leave out parts of the story. This happens so frequently. I've been talking to two guys recently that are in conflict. He's saying X, Y, and Z. He's saying A, B, and C. Neither of them were mentioning the parts where they had contributed. And it's so frustrating to be able to mediate situations like this because you can't get to the truth. Technically, nobody said a lie. They just didn't bring the parts out that were unfavorable to how they looked. Here's why you shouldn't lie in just three words. Breaks down trust. I know it's hard. It's hard to tell the truth. But the alternative is harder. The alternative is alienation, separation. It is going to come out. It's going to come out. 1 Timothy 5, some men's sins are evident. Others follow after. It will come out. It's going to come out. The question is when and where and how. And then you've got all these people in your life that you've been lying to. And what does that do? Well, they forgive you. They love you. But it breaks trust. Can't you see that? So the thing that we really want are close relationships and want people to think highly of us. So we lie to get that. When in reality, the consequence is when it does come out, and it will, the trust is completely broken in the friendship. And when this happens over and over and over again, it gets to the point where it's like, I don't even know if I can trust a word you're saying. You've been busted lying so many times. It's so hard to build a friendship. Finally, number 10, coveting or greed. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, his servants, his ox, donkey, anything. You cannot covet. Greed. On the rise in our culture for sure. Look at this. Check this out. In 1950, houses were 1,100 square feet, 3.67 people per household. All right, today, 2020, houses are 2,300 square feet with 2.6 people per household. They're more than twice the size with one less person on average. Bigger, better. We need bigger patios, bigger back decks, bigger basements, bigger screens, big, 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 big. Everything's got to be big. And we have smaller families. Materialism, greed. Doesn't make you happy. It doesn't. People think if I make more money, I'm going to be happier and stuff. That's true if you're poor. If you can't get by, getting up to a certain range is helpful. However, once you reach a certain range where you have a career and you're paying your bills, there's no help when it comes to materialism. It doesn't bring happiness into your life. Think about this comparison, this study from 2010. People with gratitude, when it came to depression, way less depressed than people who were into materialism. They're actually a little bit more depressed. Not by much, but a little bit. What about social integration, the kind of person you'd want to be around, be friends with, that kind of a person? Gratitude, way better. Materialism, minimal. Think about that. When somebody is always talking about their stuff or their car or their job or their career or their money, they're so two-dimensional. They're so boring. I can't relate to this at all. People who are grateful all the time, very magnetic. You want to be around people like that. What about emotional health in general? This will blow your socks off here. Check this out. Materialism hurts your anxiety, it hurts your depression, it hurts your subjective well-being, and mostly your self-image. Your self-image is, how much am I making lately? And when the stock market goes up, you go up. When the stock market goes down, you go down. When the banks are doing well, you're doing well. When the banks burst, which I really hope they don't, then you're not doing well at all. This is not healthy. This is not what God has in mind for your life. So let's wrap all this together. What, in a sense, are we saying? What do we learn about the law? First, this, that the Bible, that is God, had this right thousands of years ago. These Ten Commandments that we've been seeing, very good for your life. In fact, Deuteronomy 10 says you must always obey the Lord's commands that I'm giving to you today for your own good. Why is God giving us these restrictions? Because it leads to human flourishing and happiness. When you're a giver and not a taker, when you're grateful instead of greedy, when you have control over your sex life rather than letting it control you, when you're restraining yourself in your anger, all of these things lead to a beautiful, well-orchestrated life. And finally, most importantly, with a study on the law, each of us have violated these laws. I remember talking to one guy after a small Bible study, and he said to me, yeah, I think I've broken those laws. Well, at least 9 out of 10. That got me thinking, which one did he not break? Was it the murder one? I hope it's the murder one. Then again, Jesus said, if you call your brother, you know, a fool, an idiot, if you hate your brother in your heart, that is murder. So that guy was on the right track. He understood. I've broken these laws. I mean, whether I've actually committed adultery or lusted in my heart, whether I've actually tried to steal or just been so covetous that I've been greedy and hated that person, wanted their stuff, whatever. I hope you look at this list. I hope you don't feel puffed up with self-righteousness. I hope you can see very clearly this isn't supposed to puff you up. This is supposed to break you down. It's intended to show our need for Christ. Paul says, Galatians chapter 3, verse 24, the law, that's what we're talking about here, the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ so that we may be justified by faith. Whoa, the law, why was that a tutor? How does it teach us anything? It teaches us that we've fallen horrendously short of who God is. And God, it's like, God is all powerful, but that's not the barrier between me and him. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've got friends that are stronger than me and friends that are weaker than me. I'm not like, you can't be in the room with me if you can't bench as much as I can, you know? Or like, I can't be allowed in that party if I can't lift as much. No, power is not a barrier. Omniscience. God is omniscient. He knows everything. That's not the barrier between God and me any more than it would be if I was around somebody with a higher IQ and they said, we can't be friends, you and I, because, you know, I'm just smarter than you are. Like, oh, nobody does that. Or if they do, screw them. All right. The point is, it's not power. It's not intelligence. That's not the separation. The separation is moral. If you came into a party and there was a child molester there, that would be a case where you would say, that puts a chill on this party. You cannot be in here. What we're seeing here is that the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ. We see the great chasm between me and God. And who's going to fix that barrier? Jesus, so that we can be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we're no longer under a tutor, for you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus. Faith. What's that mean? Trust. Plus what? plus the Ten Commandments, plus good works? No? Plus being a good person? Is that what that says? That's not what that says. It says you're justified before God through faith by coming to Christ and saying, the Ten Commandments, I don't measure up to those at all, but I know someone who did. Jesus Christ. What the law could not do, God did through the person of his Son. And he paid for everything that we could not do at the cross of Christ. What's in your court tonight is just to admit, no, I don't measure up to that. And to admit, I need forgiveness. And if you do that, that's called receiving Christ. That's placing your faith in Christ. And at that moment, not when you die, not later, at that moment, you're justified right there, past tense. And you're forgiven and loved by God. If there's one thing you could take away from this series, it's not the morals of the Bible so much as realizing we can have a relationship with the creator of the cosmos through the person and work of Jesus.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.